The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticise. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. Today is Tuesday. It is July the 29th. It is 10:05 a.m. here in the UK, making it 11:05 a.m. over in Cape Town, South Africa, where my good friend Dr. Peter Hammond is ready for a new presentation for us. So let's bring him up right now. Peter, are you with us?
Yes, thank you, Andrew. I'm with you.
Excellent. Thank you, Peter. And the title of today's show is The Real Story of the Spanish Armada. And if you look at the show image for today's show, it actually comes from the 29th of July 1588. So we're actually going out on a proper anniversary. But Peter, where would you like to start us off with today's important topic?
Andrew, this is a great watershed event in history that truly transformed the direction of history. 29th July in 1588, the English decisively defeated the Spanish Armada in the Battle of Gravelines. This was the absolute climax of the whole drama connected with the Spanish Armada, which was phenomenally important because the destruction of the Spanish Armada in 1588 saved the Protestant Reformation in England from Spanish invasion, from oppression, from the Inquisition. And the victory of Protestant England and Protestant Netherlands, who played a part in this too, against Catholic Spain, was absolutely essential for the founding of the United States of America, the Republic of South Africa, and so much more. So world history truly pivoted on this particular event. But the story goes back to the 21st of July in 1588. A report came from Admiral Howard to Walsingham, who is basically the head of the secret intelligence service of Queen Elizabeth, reported sighting over 120 sail vessels, including galleys and many ships of great burden, heading for England. And beacons were lit across England, which inspired the whole the film on the Spanish Armada, Fire Over England. And to alert the population to the danger, and these beacons from the very south of England went all the way through to alert people, and church bells rang and special services were held, praying for God's protection from the Armada and the Inquisition, which would follow with it. And Philip II of Spain had called the Catholic world to a crusade against Protestant England and against the heretic Queen Elizabeth I, as they called her. It was English gold and support that was bolstering the Protestant cause in Scotland and the Netherlands. And at that time, Netherlands was a colony of Spain. And so with Philip having conquered Portugal and expanded Spain's Atlantic power, he ordered his admirals to assemble an armada which could crush the Protestants in England once for all. And by May 1588, Philip had prepared a fleet of 130 ships, 2,400 cannon, over 30,000 men, the greatest naval force the world had ever seen to that date. It was called the Invincible Armada, a little bit boastful and a bit premature, it would seem, but that was what they called it, the Invincible Armada. And the plan was for the Armada to sail up the English Channel, pick up more troops from Spanish Netherlands under the Duke of Parma and escort his invasion barges across the channel to conquer England. And Queen Elizabeth ordered the entire nation to pray for God's intervention and for God's protection against this ominous invading armada from Spain. Had the Spanish armada succeeded, today's world would be unrecognizable. So much was at stake. Spain was the Catholic superpower. And as England led the Protestant cause, Spain led the Catholic cause. All Europe feared Spain. Spain had overwhelmed all its adversaries, even the Turk. Had the armada succeeded, the whole future and subsequent history of England and Scotland would have been dramatically changed. I mean, imagine England could have become totally Roman Catholic. Scotland could have been totally Roman Catholic. You could not imagine the future of England or Scotland if the armada had succeeded and the British had failed to stop it. There would have been no Protestant North America, no Anglo-Saxon civilization in North America, or for that matter in the South of Africa. It would have made Spain the unrivaled superpower, and Spanish would be the world language. Today, Spanish would predominate rather than English if the armada had succeeded. The English had an army of at most 20,000 men assembled at Tilbury to oppose the anticipated 30,000 men in the Spanish armada. In addition, a further 15,000 Spanish troops under the brutal Duke of Parma were to be ferried across the channel in barges from the Netherlands. And Queen Elizabeth made one of the greatest speeches ever at Tilbury in these words: "I'm come amongst you, as you see, resolved in the midst and heat of battle to live or die amongst you all, to lay down for my God and for my kingdom and for my people, my honor and my blood, even in the dust. I know I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and the stomach of a king, and a king of England too. And I think foul scorn that Parma or Spain or any prince of Europe should dare to invade the borders of my realm, to which rather than any dishonor should grow by me, I myself will take up arms. I myself will be your general, your judge, and your rewarder of every one of your virtues in the field." And this Royal Navy had been under the control of Sir John Hawkins since 1573. And John Hawkins had rebuilt and reorganized the Royal Navy, which had survived from the days of Henry VIII. And the castles which had towered above the galleon decks were cut down. The keels had been deepened. The designs had concentrated on seaworthiness and speed. And most significantly of all, Hawkins had installed heavier long-range guns. Knowing he could not outproduce or outnumber the Spanish in terms of size or number of galleons, Hawkins determined to batter the enemy from a distance with a superior range of his long-range cannons. And the Spanish armada carried many cannon, 2,400 cannon actually, but these were really only suitable for short, close-range salvos before grappling and boarding the enemy vessels for hand-to-hand combat. Naval battles at that stage were mostly hand-to-hand combat flowing onto enemy vessels rather than destroying vessels at a distance. They went always for come close and grapple and board. So to oppose the Armada's 130 ships, Hawkins only had 34 vessels. And to oppose the 30,000 men, Hawkins only had 6,000 men in the Royal Navy. His commanders were Lord Howard and Sir Francis Drake. And it was Sir Francis Drake's famous raid on the Spanish Armada in port at Cadiz in 1587, which had delayed the sailing of the Armada by destroying a large quantity of both the ships and the stores. And this was described as the singeing of the King of Spain's beard. The Armada left Tagus on the 20th of May, and it was afflicted by severe storms. Two of their 1,000-ton ships lost their masts and had to fit in at Coruña in order to refit. They couldn't sail again until the 12th of July. And the intelligence report of 21st of July from Howard to Walsingham reported sighting 120 sail vessels, including galleys and many ships of great burden. So beacons were lit across England to alert the population to the imminent danger. The church bells were rung and special church services were held. The country was in prayer for God's protection. And the English engaged Armada in a four-hour battle, pounding away with their long-range guns, but being careful to stay out of range of the Armada's cannon. And there was a further engagement on 23rd of July and then off the Isle of Wight on 25th of July. And the guns of the English ships raked the decks of the galleons, killing many of the Spanish crew and soldiers. On the 28th of July, the Spanish Armada anchored in the English Channel near Calais. And as the English Royal Navy lay upwind from the Spanish, they determined to set adrift 8 fireships filled with explosives to drift towards the crowded Spanish fleet at anchor. And as the Spanish crews awoke to see flaming ships drifting towards their anchored armada, they panicked. Spanish captains cut their cables, losing their anchors, jettisoning the anchors, making for the open sea. Many collisions followed, and the surviving ships of the armada headed eastwards towards Gravelines, expecting to link up with the Duke of Parma's troops and barges from the Netherlands to be escorted for the invasion of England. But the tides and the winds were against them, and the Dutch did their part in undermining the armies that were meant to be embarked from the Netherlands. And the Spanish found no sign of the Duke of Parma's troops in the Dunkirk harbour. So at this point, the Royal Navy caught up with the Spaniards, and a long, desperate fight raged for 8 hours. And that was what happened on the 29th of July in 1588, what we're remembering today. The English reported that they had damaged and sunk many Spanish ships, driven others onto the banks, but they had to end the battle when they ran out of ammunition. The English had completely exhausted their gunpowder and their shot, and they said otherwise scarcely a Spanish ship would have escaped. They literally pounded away until they had no more ammunition left to use. And the remnants of the defeated armada now fled northwards. They were afraid of coming back through the English Channel where they'd already been harried so harshly for the previous week. So they chose to rather keep going north and go over the north of Scotland and hoping to go around Scotland and Ireland and through the Atlantic to reach Spain without being harried by the English fleet again. But they faced mountainous seas, racing winds, and westerly winds drove 2 of the galleons to wreck on the coast of Norway. And ships that had been shattered by the English cannonade were now struck by storms. Another 17 ships were wrecked on the coast of Britain. And many of them were basically massacred by the local population when they landed on the coast of particularly Ireland. I think Ireland and Scotland were very harsh environments for the Spanish who were shipwrecked. Most of the once mighty armada were lost before the battered survivors could finally reach Spanish ports again in October. And incredibly, aside from the fireships that were deliberately set adrift, the English had not lost a single ship, and scarcely 100 men had been killed or injured on the English side in this ferocious series of engagements against the Spanish armada. And although they were limited in their supplies and their ships and ammunition, the tactics of Admiral Hawkins and Howard and Drake had been crowned with success. A medal was struck to commemorate the victory, and it bore the inscription, "God blew and they were scattered." Another inscription was, "Man proposes, God disposes." So a major victory, not just a great naval victory, but a phenomenal answer to prayer. So while ships throughout England were holding extraordinary prayer meetings, devastating storms wrecked the Spanish plans, and the Duke of Parma's invasion barges from the Netherlands were prevented from linking up with the armada by Dutch rebel activity. And the English tactic of setting fireships amongst these huge Spanish galleons created tremendous confusion. There was courageous action by the English seamen, and there were the continuing storms which decimated, broke up the Spanish armada. So most of what was left of Philip's grand fleet was devastated by more storms on the coast of Scotland and Ireland. Man proposes, God disposes. God blew and they were scattered. Only a miserable remnant of the once proud armada limped back to the ports of Spain. 51 Spanish ships had been lost, along with 20,000 Spanish soldiers, the conquistadors. The greatest superpower in the world at that time suffered a crippling, decisive blow. The defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588 marked a great watershed in history. It signaled the decline of Catholic Spain and Portugal, and it signaled the rise of Protestant England and Holland, who became the great sea powers of the 1600s. So before 1588, the world powers were Spain and Portugal. And these Roman Catholic empires dominate the seas, and they dominated the overseas possessions of Europe. Only after the English defeated the Spanish Armada did the possibility even arise of Protestant missionaries crossing the seas. For example, the great reformer of Zurich, John Calvin, trained and sent out missionaries to Brazil, but they survived only a few days before being captured and executed in Brazil. The fact is, there was no way for Protestant vessels to cross the oceans at that time. That was dominated by the Spanish and the Portuguese. And so foreign missions was not even possible, much as they tried. There were missionaries sent out from Geneva who went far to Iceland, to Poland, to Lithuania, and as far as Brazil. But the Brazil venture was a failure because they were identified even on the ship as not Roman Catholic, but probably Protestant. They were watched by the Inquisition when they arrived in Brazil, and they were soon executed. So foreign missions wasn't even possible before there were Protestant naval powers such as Netherlands and Great Britain who were able to protect their people and their ships going across the seas. The whole future of North America would have been vastly different if the Spanish Armada had succeeded. Catholicism would have dominated instead of Protestant pilgrims. And so North America would have been very different from what it is now if the Catholics had won the battle at Gravelines back in 1588. So by the grace of God, the destruction of the Spanish Armada in 1588 saved the Protestant cause in England from Spanish invasion, saved England from oppression and from the Inquisition. And the victory of Protestant England and of Protestant Netherlands against Catholic Spain was absolutely essential for the development of England and Great Britain as a Protestant nation and empire, and the founding of the United States of America and the Republic of South Africa. All were dependent on the defeat of Spain and the victory of England at the Battle of the Spanish Armada at Gravelines, 29th of July in 1588. Now, there was a very interesting film produced, Elizabeth, The Golden Years, which had a scene, a very powerful series of scenes on the Spanish Armada battle and the effect of the fire ships. And Sir Walter Raleigh played a real major role in that film. And it was interesting, but it wasn't that historical, actually. And Walter Raleigh was an extraordinary combination of a soldier and a sailor, an adventurer and a pirate against Catholic Spanish, mind you, a scholar, a poet, a navigator, and an explorer. Walter Raleigh was also an historian and a parliamentarian, an entrepreneur and a courier. And his charisma and his courage and chivalry made him a favorite of Queen Elizabeth. And he did establish the first English colonies in the New World, which he called Virginia, in honor of the Virgin Queen Elizabeth I. So, by all accounts, Walter Raleigh was a brilliant scholar. He studied law. He had fought in the Netherlands with the Dutch Protestants against the Spanish. But there's no actual evidence that Walter Raleigh was romantically involved with the Queen. And that disinformation was a goal of the Spanish government, with which England was at war. And so the Spanish propaganda was to portray the Virgin Queen as, quote, an illegitimate bastard and, quote, a whore. So they regularly insinuated that this dashing young man and all the other dashing young men who served the Queen as soldiers and sailors were also her lovers in their terms. So it's clear that was nothing but malicious slander and propaganda during a time of war. But Hollywood has chosen to give new life to these old wartime propaganda points of the Spanish dating back four centuries. Walter Raleigh had fought on the side of the Huguenot Protestants in the French Wars. He fought with the Dutch freedom fighters in the Netherlands, and in 1580 he helped put down an Irish rebellion. But he played no role in the defeat of the Spanish Armada. In Elizabeth, the Golden Years film, Walter Raleigh is depicted as playing a central role in the battle, if not the central role. However, he was responsible for organizing land defenses. He wasn't on board any of the English ships during the Battle of the Spanish Armada. Not the first time Hollywood's got things wrong. the Royal Navy was ably led by Admirals Lord Howard and Sir Francis Drake, but Elizabeth, the Golden Years film, doesn't even mention the pivotal role of Sir Francis Drake. And it was Sir Francis Drake who was the first Englishman to circumnavigate the globe in a ship, the Golden Hind, for example. Well, Walter Raleigh was brought up in Devon, studied at Oxford, and after fighting in France and Holland and putting down a rebellion in Ireland, he was brought to the attention of the royal court of Queen Elizabeth. And there's accounts of him laying his expensive cloak across a muddy puddle to allow the queen to walk across without her shoes being sullied by the mud. And that probably happened. Raleigh was granted vast estates in Ireland, valuable trade monopolies to the New World, control over Cornish tin mines, political positions in Devon and Cornwall, and membership in the House of Commons. And during the campaign in Ireland, Raleigh had to deal with a very savage, treacherous, skilled enemy who didn't operate within the codes of civilized conduct. He didn't only have to fight the Catholic guerrillas, but professional Spanish soldiers who were in Ireland as well. On one occasion, Sir Walter Raleigh captured Lord Roche out of his own strongly garrisoned castle, and Raleigh marched Roche across 20 miles of hostile territory in pouring rain in the dead of night. And it was his assignment to report to the Queen concerning the pulling down of the rebellion island that brought him to the attention of Queen Elizabeth in 1581. And Raleigh made him captain of the guard, created him as a knight, and granted him Durham House and 40,000 acres in Ireland, an estate in Dorset. And all these favors from Queen Elizabeth earned Raleigh the envy and the jealousy of many of his contemporaries. And Queen Elizabeth gave Raleigh a charter to discover remote, heathen, barbarous lands not possessed by any Christian prince or people, and to take possession of them in the name of the Queen. Raleigh reported back that Virginia was the paradise of the world, and he brought back novelties in the ways of plants and food and tobacco. That would have been best if he hadn't, but that's the fact of history. Cotton he called grass silk, and potatoes he called paternoster, or our daily bread. And he reported that the soil in Virginia was so rich it could yield 3 harvests a year. He also brought back 2 natives, Juan Chisi and Manteo, who were well received at court as real celebrities. But Raleigh was then unofficially commissioned to organize English raids on Spanish commerce. So as the gold and silver from the New World, the Americas, was being used to finance Spanish wars of aggression against the Protestant allies in the Netherlands and Scotland, and to build up an invasion force to conquer England, the privateers or pirates of Sir Walter Raleigh were able to serve both to deny resources to the enemy and to help finance to build up British ships and arms to counter the Spanish threat. And in 1583, he organized expeditions to Newfoundland and what he named Virginia. In 1585, he established the first English colonies in America on Roanoke Island in what today is called North Carolina. And in 1587, Raleigh dispatched another expedition to Roanoke Island, but none of the colonies of these 2 expeditions survived. Those that didn't die of disease were massacred by the local Indians. And none of this is brought out in the film Elizabeth the Golden Years, but that's just a bit of background. If you want to see a film depicting the Spanish Armada, Elizabeth the Golden Years is a very dramatic recent one, but there was Fires Over England, which was produced back in 1930s, which I think is probably more accurate. But the interesting that the Elizabeth film makes no reference to the tremendous fight for freedom raging in nearby Holland, or the key role of Elizabeth in seeking to assist the Dutch with weapons and finance, and even a military expeditionary force of thousands of English troops. And the Catholic campaigns against the Protestant Huguenots in France were not referred to, even though Sir Walter Raleigh had been involved in both those conflicts. One wonders why they did not do that. But much is made in Elizabeth's film of Sir Walter Raleigh's secret marriage with Elizabeth's maid of honor, Bessie Throgmorton. And in fact, Raleigh did have an affair with the Queen's maid, and he was imprisoned in the Tower of London as a result. the Queen obviously didn't take lightly to these sort of things. And he was released at the time of the Spanish Armada, not to be involved in the battle on the sea, but to organize the land troops. And he was required to marry Bessie and retire in semi-exile to his house at Sherborne. So Sir Walter Raleigh was not only a soldier, but a scholar and a scientist. And he wrote best-selling books like The Discovery of the Large, Rich, and Beautiful Empire of Guinea, which is what they were calling America at that time. And The History of the World is another book of Raleigh. He was commissioned by Elizabeth to carry the English flag to South America. And the charter contained the unusual warning against violating the territory of any Christian monarch, which apparently included the King of Spain. The area he explored is now called Venezuela, although despite a strenuous effort, he wasn't able to find any of the fabled gold mines of this apparent El Dorado. So in 1596, Raleigh joined Admiral Lord Howard and the Earl of Essex in a massive raid against the Spanish port of Cadiz, where a new armada was being launched against England. And the English fleet of 150 vessels, manned by over 6,000 soldiers, carried more than that number of soldiers too, stormed Cadiz, destroyed, burned, or sank most of the Spanish fleet. And during this action, Raleigh received a severe gunshot wound in the leg. It would be good if they made films on people like this, which were historical. You don't need to fictionalize these things. The reality is quite amazing enough. Upon the death of Queen Elizabeth, though, and the accession of James I, Raleigh was arrested in 1603, cast into the Tower of London, and James I accused Raleigh of having had a role in the execution of his mother, Mary, Queen of Scots, which wasn't true. The trial was a disgraceful parody of judicial proceedings, really a kangaroo court. The accusations were false. The evidence was perjured. At least two of the judges were bitter enemies of Raleigh. So Raleigh was sentenced to death, to die the death of a traitor. But the sentence wasn't carried out, and the unjustly condemned man was incarcerated in the Tower of London for 13 years. But he occupied his time in writing his gigantic History of the World. And finally, in 1617, James I was induced to release this illustrious captive on condition that he sailed for El Dorado to enrich his monarch with a fortune in gold. In May 1617, a fleet of 10 vessels sailed out of Plymouth under Sir Walter Raleigh, but Raleigh could not have known that his doom had been sealed. James, with incredible duplicity, had informed the Spanish Armada of all the details of Raleigh's expedition. In his fight with the Spaniards, Raleigh's son was killed and his weary, disheartened men mutinied. His second command shot himself and Raleigh returned home in defeat, at once to be arrested and sentenced to death. Raleigh went to his death with courage and with chivalry, advising an acquaintance to come early so as to get a good seat. As for myself, he said, I am sure of one. And when he saw an old man in the crowd with a bald head, exposed to the bitter cold, he took off his own cap and threw it to him, saying, you have more need of this than I. And arriving at the scaffold, he picked up the axe and, running his finger across the edge, commented, this is sharp medicine to cure all my diseases. And the courage and Christian faith expressed on the scaffold by Walter Raleigh impressed all who were there. And one of the spectators cried out, where shall we find another such head to cut off? Walter Raleigh was heroic and adventurous, intelligent and humorous, bold and brilliant. He was described as an hero of an heroic age. And unfortunately, the Elizabeth film doesn't do any justice to either Walter Raleigh or Queen Elizabeth. It would be better if filmmakers would remain faithful to the facts of history, because the truth is more incredible than the fiction. But plainly, the defeat of the Spanish Armada was a great watershed in history. We should remember and be grateful for it. We should praise God for it. And also bear in mind that the truth is greater than fiction. And man can propose, but God disposes. And God blew, and they were scattered. The invincible Armada came to a sticky end at the Battle of Gravelines on the 29th of July, 1588. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Peter. Yes, it's interesting because all those tales you told about Sir Walter Raleigh, all the things he was involved in, also setting up those colonies in America that didn't survive, things like that. These are a part of history that many of us don't really look at because we kind of, we have a tendency to, certainly I do, is to look at what's going on in the world today and see where that stems from historically. And so the Spanish don't appear to have much power in the world today. They're obviously still a big nation, but they wouldn't be called, you know, if they're talking about leading powers in the world, it's going to be the United States, Russia, China, and then out of Europe, it seems that there's more emphasis on the likes of the UK and Germany and France than Spain. They're sort of not on the top level, even though I believe that they might be. I'm not sure if they're one of the, I don't believe they're in the G8, but doesn't really matter. What are your thoughts on how, you know, do you have any more information as to how, what happened to Spain after that? Because we also had when the Moors came into Spain, things like that. Did they really collapse over a period of years? What can you tell us about that?
Well, of course, Spain was controlled by the Muslim Moors for 800 years, but that was completely reversed by the Reconquista, which was an 8th-century battle to win back Spain. In fact, Charlton Heston starred in a big-screen epic El Cid, which dealt with the Reconquista, as Spain managed to gradually liberate themselves from Islamic oppression. And that's why Spain became so powerful, because for centuries they were honed in battle. There was a time when Spanish steel was the best in the world. They made the best swords in the world. They had the best warriors. And Spain grew to have the greatest navy in the world because they were fighting to free themselves from the Islamic oppression and occupation of the Moors. And that's also why Europe got involved in the slave trade, because Spain started to enslave people of Africa by revenge, because they'd been enslaved by the Moors from Africa over 8 centuries. And so Europe got involved in the slave trade through Spain, because Spain had learned a brutal way of behaving and punishing your enemies, and learned this, the slave trade through the Islamic occupation. But remember, in 1492, Granada fell, the last Islamic stronghold in Spain, and that's when Columbus sailed the ocean blue, 1492. As Spain was freed from Islam, they were able to direct their attention to sponsoring, out went Christopher Columbus. And you can just see how it was God's hand that restrained them from settling in North America. The Spanish settled South America and Central America, which of course had more pleasant climate and not the harsh cold of the North. And they were of course more comfortable with Mediterranean, mild climates and warm climates. So they settled South and Central America. And that's where Spain got so rich, phenomenally rich. They dominated the Americas. They got huge amounts of wealth from the mines, gold, silver, so many other valuable things. And Spain grew to be the superpower. They, of course, defeated the Turks at the last great naval battle by rowing vessels. And that was one of the great turning points. And that's before the Spanish Armada. They had won in 1572 the great battle that was just off the coast of Greece and Corinth, where they defeated the Turkish navy, and that established them as they were the greatest naval power, the greatest military power. 8 centuries of learning how to fight against slavery to reconquer your country. Spain had become a tough country, a disciplined country. They became phenomenally rich. But all that changed when they lost the battle against Britain in the Spanish Armada of 1588. And then one after the other of the Spanish colonies in South and Central America rebelled and broke away from Spain. So Spain lost their empire over several years. And then, of course, there was the American war against Spain in 1898. Remember the Maine, which was a false flag, mind you, where an American battleship called the Maine was blown up in the Havana harbor of Cuba. And America used that as a pretext, which was almost certainly a false flag, used it as a pretext to take all the Spanish colonies left away from them, which includes Philippines, which is how America got to the Philippines, how America got Guantanamo Bay, how they managed to take so many of the Spanish islands. The U.S. Navy was pre-positioned in the Pacific and in the Caribbean to take down Spain. And that was like the last nail in the coffin of the Spanish Empire. Spain then had civil wars. They had wars of Spanish succession and one after the other. Basically, Spain lost its position militarily, politically, and economically in the world. And it was the United States of America that did the last final death knell of Spain as a great worldwide empire. And the Spanish had built up a phenomenal empire across the world, and they lost almost all of it by the end of the 19th century. By 1898, America just sunk their navy, taken their countries and their overseas colonies, and Spain was reduced to just a European power. And then they had all these civil wars in Europe too. So Spain really got hammered down, but they were rebuilt significantly under General Franco, who definitely did a great job in defeating the communists, who had been so much romanticized by Hemingway's and others as Republicans, but actually they were hardcore communists, getting the support of Joseph Stalin, Soviet Union, and brutal, savage, full of persecution of Christians. And there are pictures, for example, from the Spanish Civil War, where the communists, or what they called the Republicans, were lined up with firing squads to shoot at crucifix scenes and great statues of crosses and bombing churches. So the anti-Christian hostility of the so-called nationalists, so-called Republicans, who were nothing but communists. And there were so many liberal leftists of the 1930s who were glamorizing communists in Spain and fighting for them. But the nationalists under Franco were the ones who won, and they rebuilt Spain as a great economic power with a phenomenal military. In fact, Spain has a very advanced and well-organized, disciplined army, and the intelligence service is a world-class. So Spain has been rebuilt significantly, but of course, by then they'd lost all their overseas possessions. And, you know, between Britain and America, Spain was whittled down. And but all started in 1588, really. So back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. Yes, I mean, my question, going back to the Moors, I was about 1,500 years out. It was the only thing that I could really relate that I'd looked at historically regarding Spain. No disrespect to any people of Spanish heritage or interest in that country who are listening. It's just, but one thing that's come up, I just suddenly thought of this guy. This is one of the oldest conspiratorial figures. People still talk about him today, Peter. And what I'm going to do is I've looked him up. My original search term was Spanish Armada 007 because I couldn't think of the name of the person. But I've got this page come up. It's called historyextra.com and it's the official website for BBC History magazine. So this is real mainstream history, and I'm going to give you some statements that they make in this article and then come back to you for your comments. So the headline of this historyextra.com article is John D. Elizabethan 007, Scientist, Magician and Spy. It starts off with one of the most foremost thinkers in England. John D. combined science with spiritualism to rise to the top of Elizabethan politics and cast a spell over the Queen with his counsel. And while his enemies would ensure that he was ridiculed and forgotten, he lives on in the code name for beloved super spy James Bond. Who was John D.? His contemporaries such as Sir Walter Raleigh, Sir Francis Drake and William Shakespeare, who is said to have faced the magician Prospero in The Tempest on Dee, are securely bookmarked in our catalogue of British history. Dr. Dee, astrologer and confidant to Queen Elizabeth I, has no such acknowledgement. He has been painted as a deluded man who looked to the stars for guidance, dabbled in alchemy and communed with angels. But an alternative view is that he was one of the most brilliant men of the Renaissance, whose contribution has been muddied by centuries of slander. He was a polymath, engaged with the most cutting-edge science of his day, which at the time was intertwined with magic and the occult. John Dee was born on 13th of July 1527 in London. His father was a minor courtier who sent his son to Cambridge at the age of 15. His appetite for knowledge meant he slept only 4 hours a night, spending his waking hours studying Greek, Latin, geometry, mathematics, astronomy, navigation, scripture, law, medicine and cryptography, the art of writing codes. While still in his 20s, Dee was invited to lecture on algebra at the university in Paris. He swiftly became the most successful lecturer on the continent, packing halls and introducing the public to addition, subtraction, multiplication and division signs for the first time. He was England's foremost scientist, respectful of, if not an advocate for, the controversial theory of heliocentrism, the astronomical model in which the planets all revolve around the sun. Dee lifted astronomy from obscurity, taught mathematics and developed navigation systems that later would help to establish England's naval superiority. Whilst at the University of Louvain in the Netherlands, Dee studied the occult. This was not uncommon for the era's intelligentsia, for whom science and magic were part of the quest to understand God. When Elizabeth I took the English throne, she consulted Dee on a regular basis. He even chose her coronation date. It was said he cast a spell on the Spanish Armada in 1588, which sent huge waves crashing down on their ships. Although a more likely explanation is that because he knew about meteorology, he was able to anticipate the storm. When the Spanish ships approached England, Dee suggested correctly predicting that the Spanish fleet would be severely hit by the storm, so it would be best to keep the English ships at bay. Most of the Spanish ships were lost or damaged, and when the storm subsided, the English ships disposed of the rest. It was Dee's greatest moment. Elizabeth knew that Dee could do more for her and her nation. The Queen needed a spy who could gather information about her enemies, and the well-travelled and loyal Dee was her man. He used his position as a scientific and astrological advisor to accumulate the largest library in England at his house in Mortlake, boasting some 2,670 manuscripts, as opposed to Cambridge's 451 and Oxford's 379, and to build a network of scientists, intellectuals and courtiers throughout Europe, which he likely used for intelligence gathering. Dee signed his letters to Elizabeth 007. The two circles symbolise the eyes of Queen Elizabeth, for your eyes only, and seven was the alchemist's lucky number. Dee played an essential role in what one day would become the British Intelligence Service, both the real and fictional version. Centuries later, his sign-off would be picked up by James Bond creator Ian Fleming. In his later years, Dee spent time trying to communicate with angels. He attempted to apply his knowledge of optics to scrying, or conjuring spirits into a crystal. His experiments were impressive until 1582, when a bizarre character entered his life. A 26-year-old alcoholic with cropped ears, which was a punishment one got for counterfeiting coins, named Edward Kelly, was a scryer with a reputation for sorcery. Dee's wife Jane loathed him, but Dee, believing Kelly had the knack, signed him up. Over the next 10 years, the pair devoted themselves to contacting angels. When the spirits appeared, they would allegedly transmit prophecies and give pronouncements on the spiritual nature of mankind. Unfortunately, all that survives from these sessions are spirit diaries, which were dug up in a field a decade after Dee's death. These contain a complete completely new language with its own grammar and syntax? Was it celestial lingo, or, as 17th century scientist Robert Hooke suggested, a code that Dee used to send top secret political information back to England? In the 1580s, Dee left England for Poland, entrusting his house and library to the care of his brother-in-law. While away, his home was ransacked and his manuscripts burnt or stolen. Then shortly after Dee returned to England, plague swept the country, for which he was blamed. The plague took his wife and four of their eight children. When Elizabeth died in 1603, Dee lost his ability to defend himself from his many enemies, including the Queen's successors James VI, who liked to personally oversee the torture of women accused of witchcraft. Dee spent his final days alone in poverty, selling his books and casting astrological charts. He died at the considerable age of 82 and was buried in Mortlake. His gravestone, however, has since disappeared, so there is no monument to mark the life of this most learned and unusual scholar. So I ended up reading all of that because there was some interesting information. Peter, any comments you'd like to make to negate any of that information, or what are your thoughts on it?
Well, it's extraordinary. I think it's very funny that that's the origin of the number 007, you know, for the eyes of the Queen alone. But she was really the pioneer of the English intelligence service through her right-hand man, Walsingham. I mean, Walsingham really is the premier spy master, and he did this to keep Queen Elizabeth alive. She survived something like 60 different plots to assassinate her, mostly sponsored by the King of Spain. So Queen Elizabeth needed a phenomenal secret service to keep her alive, and it's a real miracle that she ended up being one of England's longest reigning queens, monarchs, in fact. I would recommend to any listeners who would like to see a good film depiction of this, Fire Over England. It's a film with Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh. In fact, Vivian Leigh got her position in the Gone with the Wind film of 1939, mainly because of seeing her production in Fire Over England, which came out in 1937, based on the book Fire Over England, produced in 1936. So it's black and white, but this is far more accurate than the Elizabeth the Golden Year films, although the modern films on Elizabeth are visually impressive, even though they're historically absolutely backward and almost worthless as far as the historical events go, but they do give very nice visuals, and the set designers have done a good job and so on. But Fire Over England is more historically correct. So if you are interested in that, it's a Selznick movie, and Laurence Olivier, Vivian Leigh, and key roles in the film. I think that's interesting way of being able to understand some of this. It's a pity that our modern films have so much money put into it, and you know they are impressive productions, but why can't they stick to the facts of history? The truth is always better than history. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. Yes. And one last question. I don't know how much you can get in the time that we have available, but I'm not sure if we've done a show on this before or not, but can you explain to the audience what the Spanish Inquisition was actually all about?
Yes, well, the Spanish Inquisition didn't start out evil, although it certainly became that generations later. Initially, because the Spanish had been under Islam and under Sharia law for so long, when they reclaimed the land, they wanted to reclaim the culture and their faith. And so the Spanish Inquisition was to deal with false Christians, traitors, people who, heretics, those who came into the church because, well, Christianity was the dominant, winning, victorious religion. And they were concerned for protecting the purity of the church from heretics. And therefore, initially, their attention was drawn particularly to Muslims and Jews who, for economic and politically advantageous reasons, present themselves as Christians, so false Christians. Now, later, of course, the Spanish Inquisition ended up attacking reformers and Bible translators and people who believed in justification by faith, were having home Bible study meetings and Bible translators, and burned them at the stake. But initially, the Spanish Inquisition was designed to protect Spain as a Christian country and protect it from real heretics and infiltrators and false brethren. The fact that it was hijacked later shouldn't lead us to condemn the very beginning. It's like the monasteries. Initially, the monasteries were the mission fields and the mission stations of Europe, and the monasteries saved Europe and evangelized Europe and discipled Europe and did a lot of good work. But later, the monasteries became completely different, corrupt, but that's generations later. So it's not fair to blame early monks like the Venerable Bede, for example, for what some criminal corrupt characters did much later. And I think you can say the same thing about the Spanish Inquisition. Yes, we as Protestants hate the Spanish Inquisition, but bear in mind that initially it didn't have the same emphasis. And from the beginning, its aim was primarily to protect Christian Spain from anti-Christian influences of false brethren and infiltrators.
Thank you, Peter. Andrew. Yes, so, okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to mention before we go? But please let the audience know how they can contact you and where they can find your work.
Certainly. I've written the book, The Greatest Century of Reformation, on the 16th century, focusing on 16 biographies of 16 greatest reformers of the 16th century, which of course deals with, very much ends with the Spanish Inquisition being a key event that signaled the triumph of the Protestant Reformation and how the Protestant nations were now poised to become the superpowers of the future. Also, I've got a biography on Queen Elizabeth I in Victorious Christians Who Changed the World, which has got 32 biographies well illustrated of going all the way from the second century through to the 19th century. So learning history from examples of excellence, and that includes quite a lot on Queen Elizabeth I too. So very important for us to know our history and to be inspired by these examples of excellence in the past. I think we can always build a better future if we learn from our history, but that must be real history, not the fake history of Hollywood. If people want to get in touch with us, my personal email is peter@frontline.org.za. So peter@frontline, FRONTLINE, one word, peter@frontline.org.za. And then our website, www.frontlinemissionsa.org. Thank you so much, Andrew. Back to you.
Thank you so much, Peter. Tremendous research and information, as always, you put into these shows. So that being said, I want to thank Peter again for joining us today and giving us his wonderful presentation titled The Real Story of the Spanish Armada. Peter and I are going to be back with you again next Tuesday. I'm scheduled to be back with you on Saturday. And until then, folks, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful week, and bye for now.